Swinging a high drive into center field. Hits at the wall. It is gone. Cassis does it again.
Again.
It's gone. It's into the bullpen. This game is tied.
He swings and rips one to center field. It's high. It's deep. It's back. It's gone. Sale winds. He fires. Swing and a miss. Strike three. It's over. The Red Sox have won the World Championship.
All right, we're back. Play Tessie, episode 330. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Rate 5 stars. Find us on the socials at Play Tessie on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Sammy's here, Pat's here, Gordon with you guys. And as we're beginning the show, or as of today, we've got some breaking news. The Red Sox have Babe Ruth on their team. Masa Yoshida in the WBC is better than Babe Ruth. At hitting.
Nah.
And hitting home runs and causing aura. Scenes of glory. The fans love him. Did you guys see the video of him standing there, like flexing to like 100 cameramen flashing pictures? Like it's like the red carpet at the Oscars.
Yeah, I saw it. And you know who I also hope saw it? 29 other big league teams.
You would trade Babe Ruth. Tell this guy he's crazy for one
rap. Let's just wrap.
I mean, I don't know why you would trade a guy who's able to hit 440-foot home runs off of 19-year-old JV pitchers. I don't know why you do such a thing. I think that plays perfectly into the Red Sox big league lineup.
Why is the simple answer? Because people keep asking me why is he so good in the WBC, and I feel like the simple answer is just that it's that the pitchers are not good. But like you also, I mean. You have a bunch of big league stars in these games, and they're not hitting tanks off these guys.
Dude,
well, some of them are.
The way that Yoshida gets discussed, it's nothing against him. It just bugs me. I saw people today, Sunday, as we record, talking, oh, he's playing well because he's so much more comfortable playing on Team Japan, and it just brings out the best. If that were any other player who was like, I'm more comfortable playing in this format, not the Major League Baseball format in Boston, we would rip them to shreds. We would absolutely desecrate their name. And we're talking about Masa like he's some cute little puppy. I like the guy. Don't get me wrong. I like the guy. But it's a little bit weird. It just gets a little bit weird after a while. I don't get it. And again, rooting for him, it's just weird.
Yeah. I mean, my thing with Masa is just, who knows? Maybe this is his first in a while healthy. This is what he looks like healthy, which I mean, that'd be great for the Red Sox if he's able to hit, you know, 280, 290, mid 300s OBP, don't strike out a lot. That'd be perfect. I think it's a matter of the level of competition in terms of how he performs the WBC. And don't get me wrong, he had big moments against, I think it was Team USA the last go round. He had a home run in the finals, I believe. And if it wasn't them, I believe it was whoever they played in the semis. I think he hit a home run.
It was Mexico in the semis.
Yes, right. You're right.
And he drive one into right field over the fence.
Yeah. So big home run against Mexico. Like he's proven that he can hit it in the majors, but it playing up in the WBC, I would speculate is mostly due to competition.
So on Sammy's point, that wasn't your point. It was the point that you've heard others make about comfortability playing on the Japanese team. It's so funny because you guys remember all these Japanese free agents and it's like, oh, there's the part of Japanese culture where they don't want to play on big league teams with other Japanese players. But then actually like Yamamoto and Roki Sasaki actually did, and Otani's recruiting these guys. So who knows how true that actually is. And it has me thinking, how many Japanese players have the Red Sox had since getting Masa? I remember one. Do you guys remember? Did they overlap? No? Yes?
I don't think so.
I thought they did for like a year.
Sawamura was 21, 22, I believe.
Oh.
I remember one, but another pitcher. Do you guys remember Naoyuki Uwasawa?
The guy with the hat that was like six sizes too big. Yeah.
Yeah. We definitely haven't had a Japanese hitter though, right?
So Sawamura, I was right. Sawamura was here 21 and 22, so they didn't overlap.
Do we need to just get this? Like, we need the Okajima to Yoshida's Daisuke.
There we go.
The Okajima. Okay. So we need like a depth infielder from Japan.
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe the biggest whiff of the offseason was not Bregman or Alonso. Maybe it was Kazuma Okamoto.
Maybe, you know, it was.
Jokes aside, to put yourselves in Masa's shoes, and I know I was just talking about how he gets spoken about like he's like a puppy dog, but but genuinely, if you had to go to the other side of the world and you could communicate with almost nobody, like, I understand how that would be challenging, especially if you were under a microscope for the sport that you move there to play. So I get that. It's just not a full cop out.
It's also not year one. Like, at this point, he's familiar, he's established, he's been here a while. It's not like, it's not new waters, you know what I mean? Like, he's been here, he knows what to expect.
It's weird. It feels like they just got this guy, but it is year four. Like, he's been here.
It feels like we just got this guy because everyone keeps telling it. The breakout's coming. He'll reach his potential.
Which is because, in part, because of what Pat said, the truth is he hasn't been healthy for an extended period of time. Like, remember, he started here after the first WBC, and he started off really, really good, gets hurt, wears down, whatever you want to say, finishes the season bad, is hurt basically the entirety of the next 2 years, gets healthy this past year finally. Once he gets acclimated to playing games again every day against the top competition in the world, has a really good last month, but I also feel like I'm maybe giving him a little bit too much leeway here. Like, there's a lot of struggles, a lot of playing and struggling mixed in there between injuries that I'm just giving him a cop out for that I don't think he necessarily deserves, but it is a possibility that that's an explanation for how it's gone. Pat?
Let me ask you guys this. Would you be content if this year, let's say he's getting consistent at bats, I'll leave the games out, just numbers wise, would you be content with him replicating his rookie year? He had 33 doubles, 15 home runs, 72 RBI. He only struck out 81 times in 140 games. He hit 289, 338 OBP, 783 OPS, 109 OPS plus. Would you be content with getting that Masataka Yoshida this year?
No.
Okay, it's interesting. Because if you say replicate his rookie year was such a tale of two seasons where he was awesome and then so bad. So it's like when you say 783 OPS and not that much power from a DH, in theory I would agree with Sammy that it's a no. But also, I don't know, it's better than what he's been the last few years, so why shouldn't we be? He's not worth the money either which way.
The reason is because it would be blocking somebody else.
Oh, yeah, well, that all that aside, like, let's say that, like, someone...
That's part
like,
of the equation. That's got to be part of the equation. If he's going to be in the lineup, someone else is losing their spot.
Pretend they got hurt. So, like, it's not because of that.
Then, sure.
So, to your point, going back to his rookie year, first half, second half splits. First half, he played 78 games. 10 home runs, 44 RBI. He walked 27 times. He struck out 36 times. He hit 316, 382 OBP, 874 OPS. Like, if he can find the middle ground between his OPS at the end of his rookie year and the first half of his rookie year, I would call that a good year.
And not to forget, his first 13 games, like you talk about how good that first half was. His first 13 games, he hit 167 with a 560 OPS. He had the one home run that was the opposite field over the monster against Pittsburgh. And then he just was brutal for 2 weeks. And then I think it was the Brewers. Yeah, it was the Brewers. He hit that grand slam or something, or was it two home runs? Yeah, he had two home runs. Six RBIs in the series finale against the Brewers, and it just skyrocketed his season. I remember watching the All-Star Selection show and thinking, man, one of Yoshida and Alex Verdugo has to be named to the All-Star team, and neither got it. And I remember being like really butthurt. I think it was only Kenley Jansen that got it that year.
Yeah, it was. I don't know. It's just no matter how you slice the performance or the projection for Yoshida, the fit remains poor. And so therefore, every time I'm watching him play in the WBC, my first thought is it's another tryout. And it sounds silly. And Gordo, this is what we talked about earlier today. We always talk about, oh, you can't take too much from XYZ because it's a small sample size. But here we are talking about the WBC, a handful of games where we think maybe Yoshida can regain some of his value. And the reason we believe that, or at least the reason I believe it, is because it happens in the playoffs. If you perform well in a big atmosphere, MLB teams will take notice whether you think it's crazy or not.
Well, we talked about it during commercial breaks on radio today. Sam, I think you mentioned it, but that's how Walker Buehler snagged 20 mil from the Sox.
Your boy.
Ugh, yeah, my boy. Yoshida stat, you guys ready for this? This is starting after those first 13 games. It's game 14 through game 88 of his first year. You want to hear these stats? Mm-hmm. He hit 345 with a 942 OPS.
That's, I mean, he's had stretches where every time he comes up, he puts the ball in play and it's a hit. Like, hasn't been all bad. Yoshida's not a bad player. I don't think anyone thinks Yoshida is a bad player. Simply the fit.
He had an 8 straight game run inside that period of time where he had multiple hits every single day. That's insane.
He goes on tears, man. He's a good player. Good hitter, I should say.
So, okay, to put a bow on this, like, why is this all relevant? Like, obviously, it's super relevant in terms of the WBC, in terms of Japan and their quest to win back-to-back WBCs. Does this make any difference? Like, watching Yoshida hit home runs off of guys on Australia, off of, what was it, Chinese Taipei, did he hit one off of?
Korea was the big one.
Korea.
The worst pitch of all time.
Yeah, it was the worst pitch of all time. Does it make a difference? Like, I saw some people saying, hey, like, now the Red Sox are going to be able to, like, get someone to take on all the money. We can all agree the answer to that is no, but does it change anything at all in terms of their ability to trade him or their desire to keep him and have him actually hit in the lineup?
I mean, it shows you that he's healthy. So, yes, I think that changes things. I agree. I don't think any team's ever going to take all or most of Yoshida's money. I think the only thing, if you're a Red Sox fan in the same boat as me, who thinks that the fit is poor and he should be moved, the only thing you can hope for is that it increases interest knowing that he's healthy and can, in fact, produce, even if it is against less than MLB quality pitching.
Yeah, I think for me, along the same lines as Sammy, and this is going to sound unfair to Masa, but the needle isn't moved in a positive direction for me necessarily because he's playing so well in the WBC. It would, however, be moved in a negative way if he was struggling in the WBC. So I'm not really propping him up for playing well against lesser talent, but I would be freaking out about his fit and how I see him playing for the Red Sox this year if he was hitting like 180 over there, striking out a bunch. So the health, it's great. It's good to see. It's good to see the swing is working. He's being productive over there. But I'm not like, oh, great, this guy's back. He's a key cog in this lineup.
Yeah, I think exactly what you guys said is how it should be looked at. Like, first off, I remember there was a Cotillo article maybe end of February, beginning of March. Basically, the synopsis of it was teams are interested in acquiring Yoshida, but there is some semblance of we need to see this guy hit in spring training, make sure he's healthy before we do anything like that. And it's not to say that they're interested in taking on the whole contract or anything, but the Red Sox are interested in discussing him in trades. There was that someone with the Red Sox organization told Cotillo or admitted that, yeah, there is plenty chance that this guy isn't on the roster come opening day. What this means to me, and I never thought actually straight up DFAing Yoshida should be a consideration, but what it will mean is that teams that needed to see if he's healthy before actually seriously discussing trades, they can see that he's healthy. I don't think it's going to change the, like, unfortunately, like, you hear Alex Cora talk today before the game. We were hearing the audio on radio. We were talking about it. And he's basically like, yeah, like, if Yoshida hits, he's going to find himself in the lineup. I don't think there's any, like, they're not going to bench Roman Anthony. They're not going to bench Jaron Duran. They're not going to bench Willie Abreu. They're not going to bench Zaidan Rafaela. barring an extended crazy struggle from any of those guys. So Yoshida is not going to find his way in the lineup, barring injury. But what he can do is prove to other teams that he's healthy. And whether it be in spring training soon after the WBC or whether the Red Sox want to wait until Tristan Casas proves he's healthy to trade the guy, at some point in time, there will be a team, I think, that wants to pounce on him. And even though it's off lesser pitching, it's on the biggest stage. We're all watching it. And even if it's off bums, like all these executives are seeing this dude electrify crowds with his homers.
I'm trying to think where he could land, looking up and down right now. Best guess, Atlanta?
There's always going to be a team that's like right outside that contention window around the deadline that has really good pitching. They just don't have enough offense. Like it could be, for all we know, it could be Pittsburgh. Maybe Marcell Ozuna sucks and Pittsburgh needs any form of contact. Maybe Arizona needs a little bit of contact. Like there's going to be teams who kind of reveal themselves as the year goes on. It just stinks because right now, 90% of teams around the league are like, okay, we're set. And then, you know, injuries happen. Guys don't perform as they should. Or teams overperform and now are buyers instead of set. Like, so much can happen. I'm with you, Gordo. I think eventually, like, there is a team that is willing to take him on, even at a reduced salary. But for right now, like, he's a Sox and he will be till the earliest the deadline, I would imagine.
Really, Pat, you think there's nothing that could happen here in the WBC that could make a team? Because, I agree with you. Like, it, in a sense, like, for instance, we saw Zach Littell sign with the Nationals today. Teams like that are not going to be interested in acquiring Masataka Yoshida, at least at his full salary. Like maybe they'll take him on, like if the Sox would pay everything down, it's like a 2-year, $8 million total. And it's like, okay, we're going to revamp this guy's stock and flip him in a year. But I feel like for the most part, it would be team that's in contention. The Sox are going to eat a bunch of money. You're not going to have to give anything up. And you reasonably have a competition at least at DH.
Let me put it this way. I think if the WBC were played in December, I like his chances of getting moved. I think the fact that it happens so close to the regular season and teams are already kind of established in what they have and what they need, whatever. I think if the WBC were played in December, I would put the odds of Masataka Yoshida being traded before the start of the season at like 50%. Right now, I put it at like 25%.
You know, I'm going to amend my take. I don't think maybe teams that are not in contention actually would be a pretty good fit for him. Could give him playing time. I mean, if you're a team that's gunning for a World Series, putting all your eggs in the Yoshida basket and giving him playing time to DH without pop is a risky proposal there.
Yeah, but if you're
the Cardinals,
like, yeah, the team I mentioned, the Braves, I think their current. I mean, who's projected to be the Braves DH? Probably Jonah Heim. Like, that's not.
Well, until Sean Murphy comes back, I guess. But that he's out a while, right? Is it like?
Yeah, he's also coming off a bad season, and he's your backup catcher as well. So that the fit is a little weird. How about Miami? Miami doesn't have a DH. That's a fringe contender.
Oh, yeah. And he's probably going to have some crazy moment in their ballpark in the WBC.
They're going to get an up-close look. Miami could be one. Cleveland doesn't really have a DH. They're a fringe contender.
You'd have to go look at like who their probably like second, third, fourth, and fifth highest players are after Jose Ramirez. They pay nobody. You'd have to eat like everything.
Yeah, I'm looking now. There's a lot of teams with DHs that I would not say are better than Yoshida. Pirates, yeah, Pat, I agree, but they just signed Marcell Ozuna from the Braves.
Yeah.
So I don't think they'll move him.
Maybe if he repeats last year and it's like the deadline, but yeah.
Here's a weird one. The Diamondbacks, they always think they can contend, and sometimes they're right. And right now their DH is projected to be Pavin Smith.
Ooh. Yeah. One thing I think we can confidently say is if a team has a DH, no, there is not a team that's going to acquire Masa to play him in the field.
I would be shocked.
God, no.
Yeah.
Not regularly, at least. Maybe give him a few looks because he plays left field and teams can stomach it. But yeah, his defense is bad, Gordo. It's bad.
It's really bad. He remember that? I think it was either the maybe the Northeastern game. Or no, I think it was the day after the Northeastern game. Someone hit a fly ball that like every other one of the four Red Sox outfielders like skips over and stands under the ball for like 10 seconds before it lands in their glove. Yoshida running as hard as he can, didn't even come close to it. Not even remotely close to even diving for it territory. Like it's Dude, bad out there.
I will never forget. I remember and again, I bought it. So shame on me. The conversation around Yoshida's defense when he was signed was that the standard for defense is much higher in Japan. So a below average defender in Japan is actually fine in the U.S. And I believed it. I bought that because I'm an idiot.
Shame on you. Shame on you.
Well, the Red Sox watched him from a Ferris wheel, so we had to buy it.
Oh, my God. Don't even remind me of that.
That was the best story.
Also, Yoshida was the guy in left field when the ball went into the monster via the light.
That's pretty much
strikes. Yeah.
That's like the only image I actually have of him, because it has been a little while since he's played the outfield regularly for the Sox. The one image I have of him out there is him standing next to the light with the ball in it.
Putting his hands up.
That was ridiculous.
I'm pretty sure Jordan Lyles started that game. One of my guys, Jordan Lyles, Jason DeLay, one of my ball players that I love.
Jason Alexander. Oh, wait, look at that. He has the ball in his hand. He took it out of the light and put his hands up. Well, shouldn't the rule? We'll have to go back and watch it. But isn't the rule if you, like you pick up the ball, like you're playing on?
That would be. I don't know how that one is.
I think he put his hands up, and then they called it dead. And then he picked the ball out and put his hands up because he put his hands up right away. I think.
Yeah,
I
mean, he had to have. There's no way he reached into the light. Like that's such a ridiculous concept. There's in no world do you prepare to reach into the light for the ball.
There's shards of glass in that. There's no way he's playing that ball.
You got to be careful.
I'm checking right now to see if Jordan Lyles actually started that. He did. He pitched
that's crazy,
innings.
Dude.
8 innings.
Oh, that's embarrassing.
That's why I love Jordan Lyles. I saw him throw 8 innings, but also give up 4 runs.
That's still. Oh,
it's a good outing still.
Was it the Royals?
Yeah, it was Red Sox Royals. I went with my friend, and we were really confused when that Yoshida thing happened, like everyone else in the ballpark. But Jordan Lyles was dealing that day.
So what are your guys' overall impressions of the WBC so far? I feel like this time of year, I don't know, like we hear both sides. Like you have on one end, Kike Hernandez, he says, I've played in 5 World Series and, you know, playing – for Puerto Rico, representing my country, feels like it takes the cake over those. And then you've got Bryce Harper, the almost should be captain of the U.S. according to the Play Tessie podcast, goes out in front of the media and is like, "Yeah, I mean, it's not the Olympics."
Yeah. Okay. Real quick, Gordo, I cut you off real quick. I got to take the L on that take because that could not have aged worse. I'm like, I'm out here like Aaron Judge. You should not be the captain. I need someone fiery like Bryce Harper. And then 2 days later, Bryce Harper's like, this tournament fucking sucks, man. Snow Olympics.
It is weird. Like, you guys agreed. Like, the international players, the non-Americans, seem to take much, much more pride in this.
Oh, my God, yeah. Oh, my God, yeah.
We are so boring. We need to have more fun with baseball. I'm watching Nicaragua versus Israel right now. I can't name more than – can you name any players from Nicaragua? Not people of descent, but from the country. I don't think I can name a single one. And they got the stadium packed. They're going nuts. They got vuvuzelas, my new favorite – well, not new, but reminder of how much I love those. Like, why don't we do that in the U.S.? Why don't we have fun?
Was Jeter Downs born there, or was he – no?
No.
Damn. Okay, then I think I got nothing.
Jeter Downs was born in – Colombia? What?
What?
Okay.
What?
Yeah. I mean,
Colombia doesn't really have that many guys. He couldn't have made that team. Joe?
Can we also point out that when it gets to the international side of things and you see guys like Nate Eaton for Great Britain and just these like weird connections of like who even thought before the tournament that Great Britain would be able to field a team?
Well, remember last time? They had nobody. Like, it feels like they just didn't get a team last time because they maybe only wanted to get guys from like the actual Great Britain, and now it's like, okay, like we're gonna try to get anybody possible. Like, remember they had like a Roldis Chapman on their roster, yeah, and then they couldn't find the paperwork. Like they pulled out all the stops this time around.
I figured it out. Jeter Downs is eligible to represent Nicaragua because his father was born there but moved during the revolution. Well, so there you have it.
That's pretty good. I feel like there's guys playing for teams with lesser connections than that.
Yeah, I think it was last night or this morning or something, you had Dane Dunning, an American, pitching for Korea, giving up a home run to Stuart Fairchild, an American, playing for Chinese Taipei. I mean, like, there's a lot of weird representation, like, situations, but I think that makes it fun. It's interesting. Like, you do the lineage, like with Jeter Downs just now. It's interesting, and it's cool to hear the personal side of people's, you know, stories, how they got to where they're at. I like that about the WBC.
Do we know how Jazz Chisholm's British?
He's from Barbados, which is...
Oh, that's an English
from the Bahamas.
Sorry, no, Bahamas. Bahamas.
Yeah, you're right. English territory. Yeah, okay. No, that makes all of the sense. Yeah.
The Commonwealth of the Bahamas, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So on the spectrum of Bryce Harper, it's not the Olympics, to Kike Hernandez, it's better than the World Series. And I know we haven't gotten to the end of the WBC, and maybe there's not the potential for a moment quite like Ohtani versus Trout in the ninth inning to close out the WBC. Like, I don't know if there's a matchup that can equalize that, but the WBC this year overall does feel like it's bigger than last time, and last time felt pretty big, so that's a good thing. But on a scale of 1 being it ain't the Olympics, guys, to 10 being it's better than the World Series, where do you guys sit on the WBC in general?
I'm at like a 9. I wouldn't say it's better than the World Series, but I think it's pretty close to playoff baseball. Like, the intensity is crazy. And the thing I like about it over the Olympics is this is our thing, baseball fans. Like, this is our thing, the World Baseball Classic. It's not shared with a bunch of other sports. It is all baseball, the whole thing, start to finish. And if you were a diehard fan, you were there in 2006, whenever the first one was, watching it go from an event that people didn't even know about to now this huge global phenomenon that we can't get enough of, waking up at 5 a.m. to watch guys who have second jobs play baseball. I love it. I love it. I put it right up there, basically on par with playoff baseball.
Wow. Pat, where are you at with it?
I'm not as high as Sammy. I love the WBC, especially once you get toward, like, after the pool play's done, you get more toward, like, the tournament style. It gets to the point where it's really, really, really good baseball. I think it's just below MLB playoffs. But, like, again, like I said it on radio today, there's some extra sauce this year for, as like a U.S. watcher, as like a Team USA guy, because this is the first year they're actually trotting out the big dogs. Last year they had Merrill Kelly and Lance Lynn and all of, like, just like the most mediocre guys, aside from, a couple, Wainwright's another. They just kind of trotted out, like, whoever was available kind of thing. Like, they had some really good players, obviously, but not to the point now. Like, now it is basically, like, an MLB-wide all-star team, bar a couple of guys. But they are putting their best foot forward for the first time in years, and that's why it's such, like, so... It just draws you in. It's because you're like, we have a damn good team.
And, Pat, to build on that point... That's what's happening with Tarek Skubal right now. He was initially supposed to throw 55 pitches versus the Great Britain team, which he did. And now today, the day after, we're hearing he might want to stick around with Team USA. He felt the aura. He felt the excitement of the WBC. Pool play, by the way. This is just the appetizer. We haven't even gotten to the best part yet. And that's already drawing a guy like Tarek Skubal in to come back. It's the same thing with the fans of the sport. I cannot get enough of this tournament. I'm going to be bummed out when it's over. Bittersweet, you know, because it means the regular season's around the corner. But damn, these games are so much fun.
Yeah, my thing is, like, I 100% agree with everything you're saying. Like, I can't get enough of it. I'm watching as many games as I can. I'm watching multiple at the same time, like 3-4 screens, like however many are on. Like, I had like the Celtics and the Sox spring training and 2 WBC games on. It's awesome. And I think that the intensity from the players is heightened from even what you see in the playoffs. So you can clearly tell how much pride they take in it. For me personally, it's not even close to playoff baseball. Like, but that's just me because I'm a giant Red Sox fan. There's the whole buildup of a 162 game season. And oh my God, that is what's on the line, is what you have done every single day can just end in the snap of your fingers if your team doesn't play well for 2 days, which is what happened with the Red Sox. They didn't play well for 2 days and their season was over. Whereas this, it's like, okay, you know, we assembled this team of the Avengers, and okay, if they lose a game, they're done. But also, I mean, we just started this thing, so it doesn't feel like quite as much as on the line for me as a fan, understanding that the players feel 100% differently. And for guys who leave their countries to play baseball in America, I understand why they feel that way. I still think that this is like our version of the Olympics, and it should be taken as such. Like, it's awesome, and it's a cool, unique event, and I can't get enough of it, but I don't get the pit in my stomach when I watch like I do when watching playoff baseball.
Okay, Gordo, first of all, I want to add something to my take, and then I have a question. I put it right on par with playoff baseball when it's not the Red Sox, because I do feel like I have less on the line watching Team USA or with our Baseball Isn't Playtesty tournament, a team that I have picked. I feel like I have something on the line, but it pales in comparison to when my heart is like beating out of my chest when the Red Sox are playing, and even the wild card round, any round. So I'm with you there. How does it compare to a random non-Red Sox playoff game, like the finals of the WBC? Think back to USA Japan in 2023. How does that compare to a neutral playoff baseball game for you?
You know, I think a better question, because like I still feel like I root for USA, like I root for my country, so I still do feel like I have something on the line when I'm watching it. The better question would be like, if I'm watching, like the DR is going to play Venezuela in pool play, and they might play again if they both advance. Like if I'm watching that versus a random playoff game, for me, I still, maybe I'll say it takes the cake over the early games in a postseason series. Like if it's like game 1, 2, 3 in a 7-game series, but if it's a late series game, I still, even when watching neutral baseball, like I feel the pit in my stomach for the people watching, but I don't know, like, as I say it, if like I should feel that anyway, because the international fans feel just as passionately for these WBC games as a Brewers fan or whatever feels for their games against the Dodgers in the playoffs. So I don't know. I have to work through it mentally. I don't know. Like on the surface, I want to say playoffs, but my logic makes no sense.
No. I get what you're saying. But the fact that it's a conversation, I think that says a lot.
Yeah. No, I 100%. Because you're right. I think, remember the year, like with the Adam Jones home run robbery in the final game? That year, to me, no, not even, it's not a conversation.
Yeah, that was two WBCs ago?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do feel like the recent two have stepped it up. This current one and the one before, it felt, you know, just you got better talent playing. Like that Mike Trout versus Ohtani at bat. That was, baseball does not get much more intense than that. That was fucking great.
Pat, you're muted. How incredibly awkward.
I think I would put, like, let's say DR plays Venezuela. I would compare that to watching like a really good NLDS series or the NLCS. Like, I will be watching and I will be incredibly interested. It's damn good baseball, but it's a little bit different. It's the National League. I don't care as much, but it's still going to be great baseball. I'm going to tune in. And Sam, you're right. The fact that it's even remotely comparable to MLB playoffs is a testament to how successful this has become over the last couple of years in and of itself.
And props to the players, man, because it's like, it's these reactions, like you see, it wasn't even in pool play. It was before pool play when like the DR was scrimmaging against the Tigers and Junior Caminero hits a home run and he's losing his mind around the bases, because that's just the culture of Dominican baseball. When you play in the DR in front of Dominicans, like that's how they play. In America, like for whatever reason, baseball in the 1900s, it was like you hit a home run, you put your head down, you run the bases, and you don't show anyone up. You're careful. And I like that we're getting away from that a little bit, but it's not even close like, think about when, I don't know, like when you score a goal in hockey or soccer, you score a touchdown in football, like these guys, they celebrate. In baseball, yes. Like in Major League Baseball, we still don't really do that. But you look at some of these international games in the WBC, it's a completely different animal.
And it makes it more fun.
Yeah.
You're not hurting anybody. You want someone not to celebrate, then get them out. Like, I love it. I love it. We need more Junior Caminero running around the bases screaming in playoff games. I'm not saying do that in, you know, the middle of June in a game against the Pirates or something like that. Like,
but have fun.
It. But yeah, have fun out there. It's a child's game played by adults, okay?
Mm-hmm. Joe?
I just want to, like, take you guys back to earlier in the spring. Do you remember the game, which I think actually was last week, where the Sox scrimmaged Puerto Rico?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That was
that
crazy.
That game, I was producing that one, and from start to finish, the crowd was electric. And this is the prospect-level team of, like, with the exception of Story and Meyer and those guys. But they had, like, four different times they paraded through the crowd or whatever with the drums and the vuvuzela, Sammy, your favorite. So they take this game, just to build off to your point, Gordo, about the international crowds. It could be an exhibition where we see, like, today's Sox lineup that they trotted out in Pittsburgh, and they would be just as fired up.
Joe, that spring training game might have been the first time I've ever seen a player get rattled by a spring training crowd, because Jake Bennett did not look comfortable on that mound whatsoever. And spring training, that's the vibe, the aura that the WBC brings to the table.
And that's the thing about some of these predominantly international crowds. I went to two WBC games last WBC. It was both the United States. One was U.S. versus Venezuela, and one was USA versus Cuba. And I love to talk about how the best ballpark environment I ever was in was the 2021 wildcard game when Xander hit the home run, and just the rest of that game was electric. And I've been to a World Series game in 2018. I went to a World Series game in 2013. And the 21 wildcard game eclipsed both of those. But I got to be honest with you, in terms of just overall crowd noise from start to finish and intensity from a crowd, the Venezuelan fans in the U.S. versus Venezuela game, I mean, it was unbelievable. Like, you couldn't hear for the entirety of a nine-inning game. And I don't even think there was a pitch clock in that WBC either.
No.
So, I mean, it's a different animal than it is in the U.S. And it's something that I don't know if it's ever going to be like that here. We're just not built like that, which is weird.
I second that, Gordo. Probably the loudest, most lively crowd I've been to with 2021 wild card game, but very similar, was Dominican Republic versus Puerto Rico in San Francisco back in 2013, I believe, was that WBC, or 2012, something? I don't know. I was in high school. But the crowd is just completely locked in. It's also start to finish. It's not like just that little moment. It's pretty much the entire game, which is impressive.
So before we get to enough said, just want to touch on one thing Red Sox related that we, like, definitely should talk about a little bit, is the Romy Gonzalez thing that has come out since the last time we had a pod. Certainly since the last time we had a Red Sox related pod, because we did the Orioles AL East outlook on our last one. But I mean, Romy's had a weird spring. I mean, he showed up, turns out he's had this shoulder injury since the clinching game against the Tigers at the end of last season. And then he aggravated it over the offseason, was getting, I guess, what was it, some sort of injection? Pat, is it like a PRP? Is that what it is?
Cortisone, probably cortisone shot, yeah.
Right. Okay, shows up to camp. They're like, okay, we're going to just, like, let this play out a little bit, see how he responds to whatever the hell it is they did for a couple of weeks. And I suppose we've now gotten to the point where he didn't respond. He never really did baseball activities. And now he's seeing, Pat, is it Dr. Meester?
No, it's Dr. Dugas. Meester did Dr. Chris Dugas. Murphy's elbow. Dr. Dugas is down in Alabama.
So he's visiting Dr. Dugas. Surgery's on the table. We don't have a lot of detail, but we're going to defer to Pat here to give us maybe some of the potential outcomes here, assuming surgery is where he goes. I'm sure there's a few different types of surgeries that have different timetables or outlooks or whatever. So, Pat, what could we potentially be looking at here for Romy? And then we can talk a little bit about the impact of not having a guy that was really impactful to last year's team in an underrated way.
Yeah. We don't really know what's going on with his shoulder, right? It just says ongoing shoulder stuff. Yeah. So Dr. Dugas works with Dr. James Andrews. If you follow baseball, James, or any sport, James Andrews, you've heard his name 1,000 times. So Dugas does elbows and shoulders. The elbows and shoulders, and then they're directly tied with that's not important, a PT clinic in Alabama where Garrett Whitlock went. That being said, so if he's seeing it for his shoulder, there's a couple different options. There's a bunch of different stuff it could be, obviously. If it's something that they were thinking maybe would go away, it could be labrum E. Like, that's my best guess. I don't know for sure. But if it is labrum and he goes in and he gets a slap or a banker, slap tear, banker repair, whatever it is, and he gets it done, you're talking about 16 to 20 weeks before he's like green light to ramp back up. Give or take a couple of weeks there, obviously, but yeah. Because I'm looking at it right, or I was looking at it before we got on, at like the post-op, the protocol. And I want to say it's like 16 to 20 weeks typically where you're like overhead throwing, repetitive throwing, overhead stuff. So yeah, you're talking about like a 4 month or so, like true full-blown recovery. Green light to kind of ramp back up around 4 months or so.
So that would be March to
you're
April,
talking like
to May to June
starting
to, July.
To play baseball the earliest, I would imagine, July or August.
Right. And so now we're talking about ramping
labrum,
up.
It could be something completely different if it's labrum.
Is that like, is there a scenario here, Pat, where it could be so bad that it keeps him out the full year? Like we know from the
I'm
obviously
sure there
he
is.
Could have step
yeah,
backs.
I'm sure there is. I'm sure there's. Because, I mean, at that point, you're getting pretty close.
Yeah.
If you're talking about ramping up baseball activity come July, I mean, that gives you 2 months to fully build back up and be like a regular like he had been. If there's any delay in that, if he's down to like a month and a half before playoffs, I would imagine at that point they would just sit him.
Because, yeah, that's the thing is, like, if he's out basically until the trade deadline, they're going to operate as if he's not going to be there. Because, like, you don't even know if when he comes back. Like, we talk about this all the time. It's like, oh, with Trevor Story, for example, oh, he's going to be back. He's going to be back. And then when he comes back, he doesn't perform. It's like, oh, well, it's because he didn't have a full spring training. Oh, it's because he was hurt and was down for so long and didn't play. So with Romy Gonzalez, No disrespect. He had an incredible year last year, but obviously he's not starting from where Trevor Story before all the injury stuff was starting.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, at that point, it's you hope Eaton is good. If you need Campbell, Campbell comes up. But in the case of Romy, like, my thing is there's a lot of people who are mad that it's taken him so long to see an orthopedic or get this figured out. In his defense, like, it's not completely unreasonable to think that, okay, like, a winner, like, foot off the gas, like, I should be feeling pretty good. And then it's not until you ramp up where you're like, okay, something's wrong. Like, something's really wrong where I'm not feeling better. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, he had a setback. So he felt like he was doing okay. And then something changed. And since that change happened, I think it was, like, in January, they've been trying stuff. And the goal is to avoid surgery at all costs, whether you're a professional athlete or a human being. I mean, we're all like, come on, like put yourself in the shoes. Not only is it the quickest road back if you can avoid surgery, but naturally you as a human being don't want to undergo surgery if you don't have to.
Dude, that's like one of my biggest fears is surgery. Terrifies me.
Have you ever had surgery?
I had oral surgery. I got I had like an impacted tooth. So I don't know if that counts. It was pretty gross, but
did they put you under?
Yeah.
So you haven't. I haven't had my wisdom teeth taken out. I've never been put under for anything.
I've had that too, but that like, okay. Yeah. So I've had minor things, but
I agree. It's not like you got like a knee replacement, but that is in your near future.
Yeah, dude. That's the thing that scares me about my knee.
Yeah, like it might be coming.
I got a bad knee. I know. I feel like it's inevitable, but the day I have to get surgery, I'm going to be a mess. I will not sleep the night before.
Maybe I'll bring you like a cup of ramen noodles or something the night before.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, then you'll be good to go.
I'll need something a little stronger than ramen noodles, but yeah, maybe.
Okay, I'll give you like hard drugs.
Wow. Wow.
What? I obviously have a lane into that world.
Oh.
Definitely. You guys know me.
Ah.
Cartel Gordo.
How do you think he aggregates at 2 a.m.?
I was going to say the frozen shrimp pizza is basically considered a class 1 narcotic. So
There we go.
Well, Joe would know. Joe's the guy who does anabolic steroids on this friggin' show, so he knows about substances.
Deep in the undergrounds of Playtessie, guys.
The underbelly. Let me show you the underbelly of this show.
So, okay, if Romy, obviously Romy's not going to be there opening day.
No.
They're facing a lefty. They're not going to get Hunter Green. Who do you start? Well, do you start Marcelo Meyer against the lefty, or do you start one of IKF? Does Andrew Monasterio make the team and he starts? Where do you guys go? Andrew Abbott's going to be starting. Francona announced it today. So y'all have a lefty on the mound. Who's your opening day? We'll say second baseman. We'll say Durbin gets third, probably.
Meyer. I'd start Meyer. Lefty. Yeah, I'd start Meyer because it's a showcase game. It counts the same as a random game in the middle of the season, but it's a showcase game. You want to showcase your starting guys, even like your main starting guys, I should say. I know Meyer's not going to start 150 games, but he's going to be the primary second baseman is my guess. So I would start him on opening day at second. Also, you're facing Nick Lodolo in game 2. So he'll be sitting 2 days in a row to start the season. Not ideal. So I'd give him the opening day start and then put in Monasterio or Rob's friend Izzy.
Well, okay, Sammy, beyond that, who is your primary Marcelo? I assume you're still on board with, in general, platooning Marcelo.
Yeah.
Who's your platoon partner there?
I'd probably go Monasterio. What are Monasterio's splits like?
He kills lefties.
That's what I thought. Yeah. So well, yeah. It's simple. He's the closest to a Romy replacement. So there you have it.
Potentially acquired by the Sox, knowing what could potentially happen with Romy, because they obviously knew. Early to mid-February was the day after the Super Bowl they got the guy, so they knew.
Yeah.
Pat, who's your opening day? And is it any different than how it would be throughout the season?
Yes, it is different throughout the season. My opening day second baseman would be Monasterio. I think it's going to be IKF. That being said, I think throughout the year, I actually think the platoon is going to be Monasterio Meyer at second base. I think they just go with IKF because experience, you know, like just kind of paying respect to the vet. Been there, done that, whatever. Am I a fan of it? No. Does it make sense? It does. But I think as things kind of develop throughout the year, I do think that platoon ends up being Meyer Monasterio.
Yeah. And in the end, like, let's be honest with ourselves, like IKF and Monasterio are going to have opportunities to play, and whichever one's playing better is going to get those games. But to me, I think opening day, it's like it's in the same breath as what Sammy was saying, but I have a different answer. Like, I think you give the start to the vet in IKF who's been around. And that being said, Monasterio is the platoon guy I would start the season with Marcelo. So I'd give IKF the first game out of respect to him and what he's done in his career. But in general, I still want him being the utility. He plays first base when Contreras has an off day. He plays third when Durbin has an off day. He plays short when Story, like, he plays everywhere. The strict platoon with Meyer is Monasterio to me, outside of like the first game, because of what it means.
Yep.
So, any enough said for you guys? No. Okay. What do you got, Sammy, before we get there?
Oh, I was going to say, out of all the things IKF has accomplished in his career, what's your favorite?
Making $6 million for the Red Sox is a hell of an accomplishment.
In the year 2026, that's incredible.
Hold on. He actually did have a good year out of big-time respect for Isaiah Kiner-Falefa.
I just don't want someone to pull that and be like, what the fuck is Gordo talking about?
His greatest accomplishment is getting $6 million from the Red Sox. His second greatest accomplishment was a 3.6 WAR season in 2024, which is only 2 years ago.
There you have it.
So, yeah, talking up Isaiah Kiner-Falefa on a Monday morning for you guys.
Mm-hmm.
Hell yeah.
He's accomplished a lot.
They now
He's played
have.
In the majors 1, 2, 3, 4, and now 5 teams. That's a sixth of the league.
The Sox now have 4 guys who could theoretically catch an emergency situation.
Oh, you're right.
Narvaez, Wong, Contreras, and IKF.
Oh, and?
Seydon.
I have a source that says he can catch, and my source is literally his brother. So
it's
he
too bad.
Says he can catch. He told me.
I believe it. It's too bad we let Abraham Toro get away. Babraham could catch too.
You know what every one of the last 10 World Series winners have in common?
A starting catcher?
They all had 6 catchers on the roster.
A sixth catcher.
The sixth catcher.
All right. Let's get to Nuff Said. I'll go first on this Nuff Said, actually. I tweeted this out, but oh my God, Kyle Harrison struck out 8 guys in 3 innings today in spring training.
Of course he did.
I don't have the
energy. We knew this was going to happen. We knew it. And it's not, it doesn't, I mean, we said it at the time of the trade. Like, if you're going to get burned in this trade, it's going to be by Kyle Harrison. And we saw that team do the exact same thing the year before. Not saying 8 Ks and 3 innings in a spring training game means he got burned, but in the end, he didn't really have a path to the rotation here in general. So it wasn't like he was going to have a path to build his value back, but like, he's basically using the things that he learned from the Red Sox to succeed now with the Brewers. So, I mean, I'm rooting for the kid, but not going to say it won't be a little bit frustrating that you get a guy as the main piece for Rafael Devers and then immediately trade him away. And if he has success, it's like, I'll be happy that he had the success, but like also damn.
Good for Kyle.
Good for Kyle.
My thing with Kyle Harrison is like, sure, he could pay immediate dividends for Milwaukee, but if Caleb Durbin becomes like your everyday third baseman and is an average bat with plus defense, like I don't care if Kyle Harrison goes out and becomes a consistent 4 starter in Milwaukee. I don't, because it's mutually beneficial for both sides. That's just a team winning, both teams winning a trade. There's nothing wrong with that. This is not like the Vaughn Grissom for Chris Sale trade. This is not that. This is just a mutually beneficial swap of players. Like hopefully, yeah, like every trade, both guys work out for both teams. It's a good trade.
Well, if Harrison's a 4, 100% agreed. If Harrison is like the guy that people thought he was when he was the top left-handed pitching prospect in the sport, and he's like a number 2, then that's when it's like, okay, what the hell, man? But we're a long ways away from that. Like, we can have that discussion if Kyle Harrison becomes a 2.
I'm not sweating it. Caleb Durbin's going to hit 28 home runs and win the Gold Glove, and
you know what they say about 28. It ain't 30.
It is Christian Campbell's jersey number.
It was Adrian Gonzalez's jersey number.
It was JD Martinez's jersey number too.
Oh no. I don't think I have another.
Doug Mirabelli.
Doug Mirabelli.
There you go.
Doug Mirabelli. You got it.
Corey Dillon.
Oh, we're expanding.
Corey Kluber.
Oh, go. Say your Nuff Said.
Sorry. You could say your Nuff Said.
My Nuff Said was just going to be the, my take was bad about Bryce Harper, but we already touched on that, so I'll just repeat it again. Bad take. I still don't think Judge is the best choice for captain. I just haven't decided on who I think should take over, which basically me saying I haven't figured out how to talk myself into Roman Anthony being the youngest captain ever. So stay tuned for that.
Dumper.
He's going to have like 15.
Dumper.
Oh, yeah, Dumper. Yeah. Make it Cal Raleigh. He's the real MVP anyway.
Or at least for this year, make it Kershaw.
Oh, that actually might be the one. Like do it for the old.
Why wouldn't you?
The old lunk.
Wait, the WBC guys, is it every 3 years, right?
Yeah, 3.
So if Roman Anthony's 21, that means he can play again when he's 24, 27, 30, 33, 36. So that's realistically 5 more WBCs. Let's make him a 5-time captain.
That could be his thing. He could be the WBC guy.
He will hold, if that is true. Statistically, this is factual. He will hold every single Team USA WBC record.
I buy that. He'd have to be pretty bad not to.
Yeah.
Six WBCs. He's already gotten off to a pretty good start in this one.
Yeah. There we go.
Right, Pat, you got enough said to finish us off here?
I do. I called dibs on this one way earlier today. I cannot wrap my brain around how good Jason Tatum already looks. And I say that as like a fan, like, holy shit, like, he's back. He hasn't missed a skip to beat, whatever, blah, blah, blah. As someone who works in the field of recovery and post-op and surgery and all this stuff, I even more so cannot wrap my head around how he looks so good. Because, A, the timeline. It's, what, 10 months, I believe? 9 months? 10 months? Which is on the earlier side. It's not this incredibly early kind of thing. On the earlier side, no minutes restriction. He's not on the injury report. He's dunking, cutting. He looked phenomenal in two games he's played so far. So for me, it's the fact that he's able to play with no minutes restriction, not on the injury report. The other side of that being the mental part of it is, I would say, equally, if not more impressive to where he is physically at. Because there's so much behind-the-scenes stuff. Because it's learning how to run, jump, and cut again. The difference is doing it with, like, instruction. Like, if I tell you post-op, you know, give me 10, you know, bunny hops, 10 cuts, 10 sprints, back pedals, whatever. You can do that. It's the mental obstacle to not have to think about it. The fact where if I say, jump up, slap the backboard, just do 10 kind of rebounds to yourself, just up on the toes, but whatever. You can do it because you know it. You can motor plan for it. You're whatever. To be instinctively ready and able to do what he is doing is absolutely incredible. I truly cannot believe how good he looks.
Pat, I feel like you just put into words just how unbelievably impressive it is. When it got announced that he was coming back, I genuinely had no idea what to expect. Like, everyone that watched him said he looked really good, so I expected him to look fine, but rusty. He's definitely exceeded that. In terms of the minutes, honestly, this might be the thing that shocked me the most, because I certainly would have thought heavy minutes restriction to start. Like, I saw some people putting out 10 to 15 minutes. That to me was a little bit crazy, but I thought maybe 20 minutes, give or take, max. Like, how shocked were you to see back-to-back 27 minutes to start this thing?
So, from my perspective, because there was the whole thing about I'm not coming back to be a role player, blah, blah, blah. Which, sure, like, obviously, like, end game, you're going to be where you were. What I was kind of envisioning when it was like, okay, he's going to come back, whatever. I did not think that he was going to start. I thought that he would be on roughly a 15 to 18 minute restriction. And I thought that he would really have to build up, meaning he'd be more of a bench piece, kind of like he started that Cleveland game, rebounder, very passive. Like, I didn't expect him to, you know, drive to the bucket, to create ISOs and take advantage. Like, I just didn't think he would do it. So going into that game, when Joe Mazzulla says no minute restrictions, to my knowledge, when he said that, I literally did not believe it. I was like, this is just gamesmanship. I'm like, obviously, he has a minutes restriction. And then every time the starters would kind of come back out, Tatum was in the mix. Every single time. So the fact that he is not on the injury report, playing back-to-back games, playing 25-plus minutes, and being good. It's not like he's, like, cleared. Because I don't know if you guys remember, like, when Klay came back, Klay sucked. Klay was awful.
Remember, it's a long time ago, but remember when Paul George had the injury where, like, the bone came out of his skin?
The compound fracture
Nasty.
For his entire first year back, he wasn't even close to himself.
So for me, I'm like, okay, if he's playing 15 a game, I think he's going to be, I was going to say basically, expectation-wise, when he came back, about Sam Hauser. And I mean, as in, like, a complimentary wing, shooting threes, not super aggressive, whatever. Not the case. His first points back was a putback dunk. And he's jab-stepping, he's creating ISOs. He sunk his first three last night was, Gorda.
You basically needed him to be Anfernee Simons. Like, you traded Anfernee Simons, you got the big in Vucevic, and it's like, okay, when they made that trade, it's like, okay, Tatum will be the spark plug that Anfernee Simons was. It's not disrespectful that I even thought that.
It's insane. There's a long ways to go, a very long ways to go, obviously. But it is so reminiscent of when Adrian Peterson came back off of his ACL. Mm. Like, that was so fast. I think it was 7 months. It was aggressively fast. He ran for like 2,000 yards and won the MVP. Again, that should not be physically possible. I can't emphasize what Jason Tatum is doing enough. I cannot understand how he is doing it physically or mentally.
Joe?
How about the baseline of your first two games being 15 points, 12 rebounds, 7 assists, and then 20 points, 3 rebounds?
That's what I'm saying. And it's not even like...
Yeah.
There's no glaring difference in terms of how he looks. Sure, like the shots aren't falling, like the shot percentage isn't great. But the looks that he's creating are the same. That's the thing.
It's and not he the moves fact with that, the offense too.
I know.
It doesn't look like he hasn't played the entire season. And which is a testament to him for traveling with the team, being in all the meetings. Like, he hasn't missed anything this year.
There was in the first game back against Dallas, his first points is a putback dunk. And I was like, oh God, okay. Yeah, he looks good, whatever. Then later in the game, he was backing someone down, hit a shimmy, and had a fall away, and it fell. And it was at that point where I'm like, okay, it's the same bag. Like, there's no difference in, it's not like he's now a post-up shooter. It's not like he's like a cut-to-the-basket guy. He's creating the same exact look. Sure, they're not falling to the same clip they were. They will. But that's what's incredible to me, is that it's the same exact player.
Yeah, and the Celtics now on the books. They are the favorites in the East right now.
Second. Get the dunk boats ready, baby.
I called that before the season started. Remember? I said Tatum's going to come back. The Celtics are going to win the East, and they're going to maybe win the finals. So predictable, but still incredible. Still incredible.
I was in the same boat. I was like, oh, if they're good, he'll come back. But I thought 15 minutes a game, nothing special. He's out there, no restrictions, starting playing 27 minutes a game.
Did Pat freeze for you in the really Pat, you froze making the funniest face. Okay. I'm going to wrap it there, fellas. Episode 330. Appreciate you guys tuning in. We'll be back in a couple of days. Till then, remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Rate 5 stars. Find us on the socials at PlayTetsy on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. Had some people asking about the YouTube. We've been getting questions about the YouTube all off season. We will be back on YouTube. I think it's going to be first week of the season-ish, maybe a little after. We'll see, but it will be back. We'll have announcements to come as the season approaches, but we'll be back soon for another spring training play test. We're getting closer, fellas. 2.5 weeks till opening day. But till then, for Sammy, for Pat, for Joe producing, it is Gordo here for Play Tessie, episode 330. Thanks for tuning in. Peace.